Imagine a quarter million gallons of gasoline erupting into just a massive fireball right in the middle of a dense city park.
Ah, wow. Just a terrifying image to start us off.
Yeah, it really is. It tears through the canopy, superheats the water, and just burns the surrounding forest down to the absolute soil, leaving total devastation.
Right.
But then, imagine that decades later, prospective home buyers are getting into these fierce bidding wars.
Over that same spot.
Exactly. They're routinely dropping like high 800,000s on dated 1970s houses just for the privilege of living directly next to that exact same creek. Welcome to another deep dive.
It completely upends our standard logic of real estate, doesn't it? I mean, and urban living generally.
Oh, for sure.
Usually, people flee from the sites of massive industrial disasters. Like, entire towns have been abandoned over way less.
Right.
But in this specific location, buyers are actively drawn to it. The trauma of the landscape hasn't repelled the community. It's, in a very complex way, it seems to have deeply anchored it.
Okay, let's unpack this. That paradox is exactly what we are dissecting today. We're looking at a really detailed, hyper-local document.
Yeah, the neighborhood guide.
Exactly. It's a neighborhood guide to Whatcom Falls Park in Bellingham, Washington, compiled by a local real estate broker named Gennaro Schaefer.
And this isn't just a glossy brochure,
No,
okay?
not at all. Our mission today is to strip away that perfectly curated sales pitch you usually get with real estate material. We want to look at the unvarnished reality of what it actually means to have a 241-acre second growth forest as your literal backyard.
Which sounds amazing, but we should probably clarify that term right out of the gate. When
Yeah.
we say second growth, we aren't talking about, a pristine, untouched ancient wilderness.
Right,
It's
yeah.
an important ecological distinction. A second growth forest implies a history of extraction.
Meaning it was logged.
Exactly. It means the original old growth timber in this area was heavily logged, likely over a century ago during the initial industrial boom of the Pacific Northwest.
So it's not untouched at all.
No, what you are walking through today is the regenerative growth. The forest has reclaimed the space. So, right from the moment you step under the canopy, you are interacting with a landscape defined by recovery.
Which perfectly sets the scene for the spatial paradox of this park. I want to put you, the listener, in the geographical center of this experience.
Okay, let's set the stage.
You are standing in the middle of Bellingham, which is a bustling modern city center. You've got all the concrete, the traffic, the coffee shops you would expect.
Right, totally urban.
Then you get on your bike or in your car, and less than 10 minutes later, you've completely left that urban grid behind.
Just 10 minutes.
Less than 10 minutes. You're suddenly leaning against a moss-covered stone bridge, and the only sound is millions of gallons of water rushing through a ravine. You can actually feel the cold mist on your face.
That's incredible.
10 minutes from a downtown core. That proximity to wildness is genuinely jarring. It feels both wild and close in. Why does that make homebuyers just, like, go quiet for a second?
Well, what's fascinating here is that it's jarring because it defies the spatial compromises we've accepted in modern city planning.
What do you mean by spatial compromises?
Like, in most mid-sized or large cities, you're forced to make a binary choice regarding nature.
Oh, right. City versus country.
Exactly. You can choose the convenience of the dense urban core, but then your access to nature is reduced to these highly controlled, manicured squares.
Like a block of flat mowed grass and a concrete fountain.
Right, maybe a few evenly spaced trees. Or, on the flip side, you can choose the immersive wild forest experience, but you have to pay for it with, like, a 45-minute drive out into the county.
Yeah, you have to pack a lunch for that.
Exactly. But Whatcom Falls Park collapses that distance entirely. It takes that deep county backcountry experience and just forcefully injects it right into the city limits.
And we really aren't talking about a small patch of woods here.
Yeah.
The footprint is massive, 241 acres.
That's huge for an in-city park.
To orient you, if you're looking at a map, this sits on the east side of Bellingham. And yeah, for a park located entirely inside city limits, that acreage is staggering. It's the second largest in the city's internal tier.
Just behind Lake Patton, I think the source noted.
Yep, sitting just behind Lake Patton. But the broker draws a really sharp contrast between Lake Patton and Whatcom Falls.
Oh, this is a great point.
He argues that if you're a home buyer trying to understand the culture of these neighborhoods, you have to understand the fundamental difference in how these two parks function.
Because they serve totally different purposes.
Exactly. He calls Lake Patton a loop in a lake park and Whatcom Falls a wander the ravine park.
that distinction gets right to the psychology of landscape architecture, really.
How so?
Well, a loop in a lake park is engineered for open recreation, destination, and completion.
Completion. Like checking a box.
Right. You drive to the lake, you run the 3-mile gravel loop, you hit your fitness metric, and you go home.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The sight lines are wide open. You can see across the water to the other side. It is essentially an arena for physical exercise.
Like an outdoor gym.
Exactly. But a Wander the Ravine park operates on a completely different psychological wavelength.
Because you can't see everything at once.
Right. Because it is structured around a sunken creek corridor and shielded by a dense, multi-layered forest canopy, your sight lines are drastically shortened.
You literally can't see the perimeter of the park.
You can't see the parking lot. Sometimes you can't even see the next bend in the trail.
So it forces a sense of exploration, rather than just acting as a gym.
Precisely. You aren't there to close the rings on your smartwatch. You are there for immersion. The landscape dictates your pace.
Because of the terrain.
Yeah. You have to navigate the topography, follow the sound of the water, discover the features organically. That atmosphere of discovery is incredibly difficult to engineer.
Especially within a 10-minute radius of a commercial downtown.
Almost impossible.
But, you know, that dense topography creates some logistical challenges that, if you're a newcomer, it might seem completely counterintuitive.
The layout.
Yeah, the layout. The park doesn't have one main centralized entrance. It essentially operates as two physically disconnected zones.
The two parks illusion.
Exactly. You have the lower area, which you access off Silver Beach Road. The guide describes this as the gentler creekside side.
Right, the quiet side.
Yeah, this is where you find the contemplative amenities, the main waterfalls, the historic stone bridge, a calm fishing pond, a picnic shelter, and like a small playground.
The low impact zone, basically.
Right. But then to access the upper area, you have to drive to a completely different entrance on Electric Avenue.
Which has a totally different vibe.
An aggressively active vibe. It houses two tennis courts, an outdoor basketball court, sprawling multi-purpose athletic fields, another playground, and a dirt bike pump track.
So it's basically two different parks.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a mullet park.
A mullet park.
Yeah, business and sports up top, wild nature down below.
Oh, that's actually pretty accurate.
But when I first looked at this layout, honestly, I thought it was a failure of city planning.
Really? Why?
Because why scatter the amenities? If I'm a newcomer, wouldn't having two distinct, disconnected entrances be confusing? Why not just bulldoze a central parcel, build one massive parking lot, and have a single hub where everyone gathers?
I see what you mean, but if we look closer at the mechanics of urban planning, what initially looks like a confusing layout is actually a highly sophisticated implementation of recreational zoning.
Recreational zoning. Okay, break that down.
Think about the friction that occurs when you try to force competing demographics into a single space. Let's look at that pump track you mentioned.
Sure.
For those unfamiliar, a pump track is a continuous dirt circuit of banked turns and rolling mounds.
Lots of jumps and hills.
Exactly. The goal is for riders, usually teenagers on BMX or mountain bikes, to navigate the track without pedaling. They generate momentum purely by shifting their body weight or pumping up and down the rollers.
So it's high energy.
It's high energy, it's competitive, and it's inherently loud.
Yeah, you've got kids yelling, bikes rattling, parents cheering. It's a high decibel environment.
Right. Now, contrast that with the demographic utilizing the lower part.
The creek sides.
Yeah. You have an elderly couple trying to watch a blue heron hunt in the creek. Or someone seeking out a quiet morning walk to process a stressful work week.
Right. Very low key.
If you build a centralized hub, those two energy levels inevitably clash. The teenagers feel heavily policed and unable to let loose because they're surrounded by people seeking quiet.
And the walkers feel anxious and annoyed because they have to dodge stray basketballs and listen to shouting.
Exactly. By physically severing the entrances, Electric Avenue for high energy athletics, Silver Beach Road for contemplative nature, the city has eliminated that friction.
And the forest itself actually does the heavy lifting there, doesn't it? The trees aren't just scenery.
No, they're highly functional. They act as acoustic baffles.
That is the mechanical brilliance of it, honestly.
It really is. The dense vegetation and the varying topography of the ravine absorb and deflect the high-frequency sounds from the athletic fields.
So you don't even hear the basketball game when you're at the waterfall.
Right. And the roar of the creek provides white noise that masks the rest. The broker explicitly highlights this as a neighborhood life hack.
Oh, the life hack. Yeah, I loved this part.
Right. If you want to burn off your kids' energy, you point the car toward Electric Avenue, If you want a peaceful picnic, you head to Silver Beach Road.
It allows a single 241-acre footprint to serve completely incompatible community needs without either group feeling compromised.
It's really smart.
Okay, let's follow that contemplative route and drop down into the ravine.
Yeah.
Because the entire reason this acreage hasn't been paved over is the waterway running through the center of it.
Whatcom Creek.
Yes, Whatcom Creek is the spine of the park. It's the geological engine that drains Lake Whatcom, which is a massive body of water to the east, all the way down into Bellingham Bay.
And as the creek drops in elevation through this specific stretch of forest, it creates four distinct sets of waterfalls.
Four of them. But we should calibrate expectations here, much like the broker does in his guide.
Yeah, we aren't talking about the soaring vertical drop of a Niagara Falls or a Yosemite Falls.
No, these aren't those giant roadside spectacles that you view from a massive paved overlook.
No, he describes them as intimate.
Intimate. I like that word for it. The geology here is defined by Chuckanut sandstone, which forms these horizontal shelves.
And the water cascades over those ledges into these deep, dark plunge pools.
All right. And he points out that because of the dense foliage and the sunken nature of the creek, these are waterfalls you hear long before you see them.
Which adds to that sense of discovery we talked about earlier.
Exactly. You have the main Whatcom Falls right near the lower entrance, Whirlpool Falls further upstream, and then a middle and lower set of falls as the creek winds its way toward the bay.
And the sensory experience of that is amazing, hearing that low rumble echoing through the trees.
And having to physically push past ferns to find the source of the sound. It demands a physical engagement from the visitor.
It fundamentally changes the visitor from a passive consumer to an active participant.
How do you mean?
Well, when you pull your car up to a scenic overlook, snap a photo and leave, the landscape has demanded nothing of you.
Right. You're just looking at a screen, basically.
But when you have to navigate the topography, interpret the acoustic clues of rushing water, and discover the sandstone shelf for yourself, you are forming a tactile memory.
A tactile memory.
Yeah. That act of participation is what bonds residents to this specific piece of geography.
And speaking of tactile memory, we have to examine the architectural crown jewel of the lower park.
Stone bridge?
Yes. If the creek is the spine, this structure is the beating heart. Arching directly over the main waterfall is this heavily mossed stone pedestrian bridge.
It's the signature visual of Whatcom Falls Park.
But it isn't just a picturesque footbridge. It is a physical artifact of the Great Depression. It was constructed between 1939 and 1940 by the Works Progress Administration, the WPA.
We really have to unpack the socioeconomic mechanics of the WPA to understand the gravity of that bridge.
Please do, because it's fascinating.
By 1939, the United States was a decade into the Great Depression. Unemployment was staggering, and the psychological toll on the working class was immense.
The people were desperate.
Extremely. The WPA was a federal New Deal agency designed not just to build infrastructure, but to restore human dignity through labor.
Right, giving people a purpose again.
So the men who built this bridge weren't just city contractors executing a blueprint. They were desperate, unemployed laborers, often local tradesmen, who were put to work doing incredibly grueling physical stone masonry to feed their families.
Wow.
The bridge is quite literally built out of the economic anxiety and sheer resilience of the 1930s working class.
And the materials they used elevate that story of resilience to almost mythic proportions. Here's where it gets really interesting.
The sandstone.
Yeah, the bridge is constructed from salvaged Chuckanut sandstone. The guide describes it as this warm, tawny rock.
It's very distinctive.
It is. Geologically, Chuckanut sandstone is ubiquitous in historic Bellingham. It's an Eocene-era sedimentary rock loaded with iron, which gives it that warm, almost golden brown hue when the sun hits it.
Beautiful stone.
But the local lore surrounding where this specific stone came from is what's fascinating.
The Pike Building lore.
Exactly. Locals absolutely insist that the sandstone blocks were salvaged from the arches of the old Pike Building downtown, right after it was destroyed in a massive fire in 1939.
But the records are a bit unclear, right?
Yeah, the broker is highly transparent here. He notes that the specific name, Pike Building, should be treated as local lore, as the city's historical records are a bit fuzzy on the exact invoices.
Right, hard to prove exactly.
However, the timeline of 1939 to 1940, the use of salvaged sandstone, and the WPA provenance are indisputable facts. That's all verified by the Living New Deal Project.
Okay, so the foundation of the story is rock solid, pun intended.
Ah, Exactly. But I want to analyze the psychology of that lore with you. Even if a city historian came out tomorrow and definitively proved it wasn't the Pike Building, I guarantee the locals would still refuse to let the story go.
Oh, 100%.
Why? Why do you think locals cling so tightly to the specific burned building story, even if the historical record is a bit fuzzy?
Because it is a perfect physical manifestation of kintsugi on a municipal scale.
Kintsugi, the Japanese art.
Yes, the art of repairing broken pottery with lacquer dusted with powdered gold.
Right.
The philosophy there is that the breakage and the repair are part of the history of an object rather than something to disguise.
Oh, I see where you're going.
The lore of the Pike Building functions the exact same way. A beautiful, vital piece of the city's downtown architecture is violently destroyed by fire.
A collective civic trauma.
Exactly. But instead of sweeping the charred rubble into a landfill and forgetting it, the community hauls the heavy, blackened bones of that building into the forest.
Wow.
They use the labor of desperate Depression-era workers to painstakingly reassemble those ruins into something entirely new and enduring, a bridge that spans a waterfall.
It's the literal recycling of destruction into connection.
Beautifully put. It transforms a narrative of loss into a narrative of endurance. People are deeply comforted by environments that prove survival is possible.
That makes total sense.
When you run your hand along that rough sandstone, you aren't just touching a rock, you are touching the ruins of a fire, the labor of the Great Depression and the permanence of the forest, all fused together.
And the broker highlights a brilliant practical detail about this monument, too.
How close it is.
Yes, the accessibility. It is located roughly 100 yards from the lower parking lot, and the path is predominantly flat and paved.
So anyone can get to it.
Exactly. You do not need to be an elite hiker to access it. If you have an elderly parent with a cane, or you're pushing a double stroller, or you just have 15 minutes of daylight left after a grueling Tuesday at the office, you can park your car, walk for 2 minutes, and stand on an 80-year-old WPA bridge suspended over a roaring waterfall.
That level of frictionless accessibility to profound historical beauty is a massive driver of why people want to live in the adjacent neighborhood.
It democratizes the awe, doesn't it?
It completely removes the barrier to entry for mental restoration. You don't have to pack a survival kit to feel the mist of the waterfall.
Right. But just a short walk from that historic contemplative bridge, the park shifts gears again.
What's next?
Still in the lower area, we find another piece of 1930s infrastructure. But this one is incredibly utilitarian. The Bellingham Trout Hatchery.
Oh, the hatchery. This is so unique.
Built in 1936, right alongside the bridge and the park's expansion. It was originally a grassroots effort by local sportsmen and the State Game Commission.
And who runs it now?
Today, it operates under the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, but the actual day-to-day labor is managed by Bellingham Technical College, or BTC.
And this introduces a highly unique working farm atmosphere to a city park.
Yeah, that's exactly what it feels like.
Most municipal parks rely on passive amenities, a statue you look at, a bench you sit on.
Right, things you just observe.
Even modern nature centers often feel like sterile corporate aquariums with touch screens and plastic dioramas.
Totally.
The hatchery is the antithesis of that. It is an active, wet, noisy, highly functional academic workplace.
The guide paints a great picture of this. There's no admission gate, no turnstile. You simply walk over from the creek, and you are immediately standing next to these long concrete raceways.
It's right out in the open.
Yep. You can lean over the rail and watch thousands of trout holding their position in the current, waiting for feed.
Wow.
You might see BTC students and waders scrubbing algae off the concrete or checking water quality metrics. It completely demystifies the natural world.
It really does. It shows visitors, especially children, that a healthy ecosystem doesn't just happen by magic. It requires scientific stewardship, physical labor, and infrastructure.
It replaces the museum hush with the rhythm of biological production.
Exactly. When a child observes a student actively working to raise those fish, they internalize the concept of environmental maintenance. Nature isn't just a static backdrop for their weekend, it is a system that requires human care.
And that concept of human care leads to perhaps the most brilliantly engineered sociological feature of the entire park, Derby Pond.
Ah, Dirty Pond.
So the water flowing out of those hatchery raceways feeds directly into this small, incredibly calm pond. And Derby Pond has one uncompromising rule.
Which is?
It is strictly legally reserved for children 14 and under.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, adults are banned from casting a line. And the trout that the BTC students are raising in those concrete raceways A significant portion of them are transplanted 50 feet away, directly into Durbarpon.
Okay, we talked earlier about frictionless accessibility regarding the stone bridge. Durbarpon is the ultimate frictionless environment for introducing a child to the outdoors.
It really is. As an adult angler, it's a bit of a bummer. You can't fish Durbarpon. But isn't it kind of brilliant to engineer a completely frictionless fishing experience for a six-year-old?
It's genius. Let's analyze the mechanics of a typical fishing trip with a six-year-old.
Okay, let's hear it.
It is usually fraught with frustration. You take them to a wild river. The current is too fast for their bobber. The banks are steep, muddy, and dangerous.
The fish are scarce.
Right. And they are competing for space with adult anglers who have $1,000 gear and zero patience for a splashing toddler.
Sounds miserable, honestly.
The child gets cold, gets their hook stuck in a tree, catches nothing, and decides they hate fishing forever.
It's an overwhelming introduction to a complex ecosystem.
But Durbarpon strips away every single one of those negative variables.
How so?
The hydrology is controlled. The water is flat and still. The topography is manicured. The edges are shallow and easily accessible.
No steep mud banks.
Right. The adult competition is legally removed. And most importantly, the fish are objectively, demonstrably present because they were stocked from the hatchery right next door.
As the guide bluntly puts it, for a six-year-old with a bobber, that is the whole ball game.
That really is it.
And this ecosystem culminates every spring, usually around Mother's Day weekend, in a massive youth fishing derby.
It's a huge community event.
Yeah, backed by local conservation groups like the Northwest Washington Steelheaders. Kids show up, fish for free, win prizes like tackle boxes and rods, and catch the exact trout they may have watched finning in the raceways a month prior.
I love that.
Me too. I love the concept of pond to tackle box. The broker specifically emphasizes this through line. Raised here, caught here.
The psychological impact of that through line cannot be overstated.
Why do you say that?
When a child catches a fish in Durbarpon, they're completing a highly visible, localized biological cycle. They understand exactly where the water came from, who raised the fish, and how it ended up on their hook.
It roots them to the geography.
It roots them to Bellingham in a way that reading a textbook never could. Decades later, when those children become adults navigating the real estate market, they aren't just looking for a house with a nice kitchen.
Right.
They're looking to return to that visceral feeling of geographic belonging.
You say they're looking to return, but how do residents actually navigate this space daily? If we zoom out from these specific nodes, the bridge, the hatchery, the upper courts, we have to look at the circulatory system connecting them.
The trails.
The trails. The guide notes that the park contains somewhere between 3.5 and over 5 miles of trails, depending on how deeply you count the dead-end spurs and offshoots.
And the surfaces vary wildly, right?
Very wildly. From smooth, stroller-friendly pavement near the main falls to wide crushed gravel down to what he calls narrow, rooty, real forest single track, clinging to the steep creek banks.
Okay, so a real mix.
But the critical insight here isn't the mileage inside the park. It's where those trails bleed out into the rest of the city.
This brings us to a fundamental divide in urban planning theory. The park as an island versus the park as an artery.
An island versus an artery. Explain that.
For decades, city planners treated parks as islands. They would zone a square of land, surround it with four busy, multi-lane roads, and fill it with trees.
Right, like Central Park, kind of.
Yeah. To utilize the park, you had to interact with the hostile infrastructure of the city. You had to drive a car, cross dangerous intersections, park in a lot, and then enter the nature zone.
And when you're done, you reverse the process.
Exactly. The park was an isolated event.
But what come falls operates entirely as an artery.
Yes.
The trails don't just loop back on themselves. They connect to a massive regional transit web.
It connects everything.
The guide details how the park links directly to the railroad trail, which is a 3.6-mile long, wide gravel path built on an old railway bed. It runs from Memorial Park near the interstate all the way out toward Lake Whatcom.
So you can go miles without seeing a car.
Exactly. You can also walk directly from the fish hatchery, travel barely over half a mile, and arrive at Bloedel Donovan Park.
Which is on the lake.
Yeah, offering a swimmable public beach right on Lake Whatcom. Other trails branch off alongside Bayview Cemetery and connect up to the Silver Beach neighborhood.
So by functioning as an artery, the park ceases to be just a recreational destination. It becomes vital transit infrastructure.
for trail runners, dog walkers, kids.
A resident can commute to work, safely send their child on a bicycle to a friend's house in a neighboring subdivision, or walk their dog for miles, all without ever stepping foot on a paved road or interacting with vehicular traffic.
Which is huge for quality of life.
The psychological relief of moving through a city without the threat of cars is immense. It integrates the restorative power of the forest into the mundane, functional travel of everyday life.
But the broker is incredibly careful not to over-romanticize this walkability.
He's very candid.
Yeah. Real estate marketing usually portrays trail access as this effortless, gliding experience where you stroll out your back door with a latte and magically arrive at a waterfall.
Right. The perfect Instagram lifestyle.
This guide explicitly pumps the brakes on that fantasy. So what does this all mean for accessibility? Because the source is very clear that this is not all stroller flat.
And that candidness is vital for protecting a buyer's investment.
Definitely.
If you sell a home to a family with a stroller or a buyer with bad knees based on the promise of effortless trail access, and they discover the path behind their house requires hiking boots and significant agility.
That's a huge problem.
You have created profound buyer's remorse. By clearly mapping out the friction, by stating exactly where the pavement ends and the single track begins, he allows the buyer to accurately match their physical reality to the landscape.
He sets realistic expectations.
Exactly. It's a massive urban planning victory to have these green arteries, but people need to know exactly how to navigate them.
And the necessity of matching your physical reality to the landscape becomes deadly serious when we examine the waterway itself.
Yes.
We have to transition away from the curated safety of the trails and talk about the unvarnished hazards of Whatcom Creek.
It's not a lazy river.
Let's look closely at Whirlpool Falls. We mentioned it briefly as the waterfall upstream from the Stone Bridge.
Wow.
In the heat of the summer, this spot is a massive draw.
Oh, I'm sure it gets crowded.
It's a popular local swimming hole and a place where teenagers go to cliff jump. But the guide drops all the marketing speak here and issues a blunt warning.
What does he say?
He states unequivocally that this is not an official lifeguarded municipal pool. It is backcountry water.
The psychology of urban parks creates a dangerous blind spot here.
How so?
Because a visitor can park their car near a coffee shop, walk 10 minutes on a paved path, and see a manicured duck pond, they subconsciously assume that the entire 241-acre environment has been sanitized for their protection.
Oh, they let their guard down.
Right. They look at the plunged pool below Whirlpool Falls and view it through the lens of a municipal swimming pool. They fail to recognize it as a dynamic, deeply indifferent geologic feature.
He details exactly what makes it indifferent. The water is incredibly cold, fed by mountain runoff into Lake Whatcom. The hydrology of a plunge pool creates complex pulling currents and undertows that you simply cannot see from the surface.
And the perimeter isn't safe either.
No, the perimeter is in a concrete deck. It's slick, water-polished, chuck-it-out sandstone. He notes that people have been severely injured slipping on the rock or misjudging the water depth while cliff jumping.
Wow.
The city has even intentionally limited trail access to the Middle Falls purely to keep people away from the treacherous banks.
It is a stark reminder that nature, even when fully encapsulated by city limits, retains its absolute authority. The current does not care that you are 10 minutes from a hospital.
So true.
The broker is aggressively breaking the illusion of the sanitized urban playground.
And that illusion of safety was shattered on a catastrophic, unimaginable scale on June 10th, 1999.
The pipeline tragedy.
Yes, we have to talk about the pipeline tragedy. My tone has to shift here because this is heavy. You rarely, if ever, see an industrial disaster of this magnitude addressed in a neighborhood real estate guide.
Never. They usually hide it.
But it is the defining modern event of Whatcom Falls Park. Mm. On that day, the Olympic Pipeline, which was an underground infrastructure artery running directly through the park's perimeter, ruptured.
It ruptured.
It bled approximately 237,000 gallons of unleaded gasoline directly into the Whatcom Creek system.
Let's just consider the physics and the sheer volume of that for a second.
It's hard to even picture.
A quarter of a million gallons of highly volatile, concentrated fuel pouring into a confined ravine system, displacing the water, and filling the dense forest canopy with highly explosive vapor.
And then it ignited. The spark triggered a literal fireball that traveled a mile and a half down the creek corridor.
Just devastating.
The toll it took is difficult to even speak about. Three young people were killed. Wade King and Steven Siorvis, who were both just 10 years old, playing near the water, and Liam Wood, an 18-year-old young man who had just graduated high school and was fly fishing in the creek.
It's absolutely heartbreaking.
The fire burned 26 acres of the surrounding area, including 16 acres of mature, towering trees right inside the park. The ecological impact was absolute.
Total devastation.
It sterilized the creek, killing over 100,000 fish, amphibians, and macroinvertebrates. How does a community even process an industrial disaster of that magnitude right in the middle of their natural sanctuary?
This raises an important question, doesn't it? About how urban nature can bear scars just like people do. The ecological mechanics of a chemical fire in a waterway are devastating.
I can't even imagine.
It isn't just the heat that kills. The gasoline suffocates the oxygen out of the water, and the chemical toxicity penetrates the soil of the creek bed. You are left with a biologically dead zone in the center of a city.
The aftermath of that day permanently altered national pipeline safety legislation. But locally, the city of Bellingham faced a monumental task.
How do you resurrect a dead creek?
Exactly. For the last 2.5 decades, they have been painstakingly engaged in ecological restoration. They had to remediate the toxic soil, stabilize the burn banks, and carefully reintroduce native vegetation.
It's a very slow process.
Yeah, they had to wait for the microscopic life, the macroinvertebrates, to slowly repopulate the water so that the fish would have something to eat when they finally returned.
And alongside the ecological recovery, there is the cultural recovery.
Right. The guide notes that the community holds deep, active remembrances. They even held a massive 25-year gathering in 2024.
That's powerful.
He also mentions, almost as a footnote to the changing landscape, that an old railroad trestle that survived the 1999 fire was finally dismantled for safety reasons in 2023.
So the landscape is still physically changing.
It is. But sitting with this information, you have to wonder, how does a community continue to utilize a space that carries that level of profound trauma?
Well, this touches on the most profound point raised by the Broker's Guide.
Which is?
In standard real estate marketing, history is aggressively sanitized. You highlight the quaint 1940s bridge, and you absolutely bury the 1999 fireball. You only sell the pleasant fiction.
Right. Hide the bad stuff.
But what this community understands is that true value doesn't come from a lack of scars. It comes from the capacity to heal them.
Wow.
By refusing to gloss over the tragedy, the locals demand that the park be experienced in its totality.
You don't just get to enjoy the shade of the trees. You have to acknowledge what it took for them to grow back.
Exactly. When you walk through that forest today, you are not just on a casual nature hike. You are actively bearing witness to a quarter century of rigorous environmental bioremediation and communal grief.
The guide states that knowing this history makes the quiet of the park land a little differently.
It forces a reverence.
It really does. The water flowing over the sandstone isn't just scenic, it is healed. The ferns pushing through the soil aren't just greenery, they are a hard-won regrowth.
By actively remembering the tragedy, the community transforms the 241 acres from a mere recreational amenity into a living monument of resilience.
The living monument of resilience. And that incredibly heavy, beautiful reality leads us to the final piece of the puzzle. The people who choose to actually live on the borders of this monument.
The real estate realities.
Let's look at the Whatcom Falls neighborhood itself. Geographically, it sits on the east edge of Bellingham. It's bordered generally by the Creek Corridor to the north and Bayview Cemetery to the west, with the major arterial of Lakeway Drive cutting through it.
Okay, so we're getting a clear picture of the map now.
It's a relatively intimate pocket of the city, home to just over 2,000 residents. But the housing stock here defies the typical suburban model.
Oh, completely. In a standard American suburb, you usually see architectural homogeneity.
Right, cookie cutter houses.
Yeah, a developer buys a massive tract of land in 1985, builds 500 identical split-level homes, and the entire neighborhood is frozen in that specific architectural era.
But the guide explains that Whatcom Falls is one of the few in-city neighborhoods that retained enough open, buildable space to develop gradually over decades.
She has a mix.
It is wildly eclectic. You can walk down a single street and see modest single-story ranch homes from the 1950s sitting next to what he calls minimal traditional homes.
And let's clarify that term for the listeners. Minimal traditional refers to those very simple, unadorned, boxy houses built largely during the economic constraints of the Great Depression and the immediate post-WWII housing boom.
Right. They have no fancy eaves or porches, just simple boxes.
Exactly.
But right next to those 1940s boxes, you'll find sprawling 1990s traditional two stories. And interspersed among all of them is brand new 2000s era craftsman style construction with heavy timber accents and modern finishes.
The implication of that extreme architectural diversity is crucial for understanding the local real estate market.
How so?
It means the neighborhood's value is not derived from its housing stock. You aren't buying into the neighborhood because it has the best mid-century modern architecture in the city, because it doesn't.
You are buying the geography.
Exactly.
The broker calls it the park-adjacent premium. Buyers are paying purely for access and atmosphere.
The location.
They're buying the heavily wooded setting. They are buying the fact that the trail artery is quite literally out their back door.
It's about the lifestyle.
They're buying the logistical reality that they can walk to Lake Whatcom at Bloedel Donovan Park, drive to downtown in 10 minutes, or ride their bike straight to Galbraith Mountain.
Galbraith Mountain.
Yeah, the guide notes it is a massive, world-class mecca for mountain biking located just to the south.
Oh, right. So they are purchasing a bundled lifestyle matrix, not a floor plan.
Let's look at the financial reality of that matrix. The broker provides a market snapshot from early 2026.
Okay, let's hear the numbers.
The median sale price in this eclectic neighborhood is sitting in the high 800,000s.
Wow.
And inventory moves incredibly fast, usually going under contract in less than a month.
So it's highly competitive.
Very. But here is where he issues his final, most practical warning. He tells buyers that a median price is a statistical illusion.
What does he mean by that?
The actual value of a home here fluctuates wildly based on the exact lot size, the specific era the home was built in, and its true proximity to the creek corridor.
Ah, so it's not a flat rate.
Right. He specifically cautions that the marketing phrase, walkable to the falls, is highly elastic. It gets stretched by listing agents to cover a wide variety of actual distances and difficult topography.
Oh, I'm sure walkable is a very loose term sometimes.
Exactly. Furthermore, he warns that if you are dropping nearly $1 million on one of those older 1970s ranches, you need to retain serious cash reserves.
For renovations.
Yes, for intense inspections and the inevitable replacement of dated electrical and plumbing systems.
It's an incredibly grounded piece of advice that forces the buyer to separate the romance of the forest from the financial reality of homeownership.
So I have to pose the ultimate question to you, analyzing this from an economic perspective.
Okay, hit me.
You are a buyer staring at a house built in 1976. The kitchen cabinets are peeling, the roof might have 3 years of life left, and the plumbing is a massive question mark.
Sounds expensive.
But out the kitchen window, you can see the trail leading down into the ravine. The broker argues that the durable fundamentals of the geography will protect the home's value even when the market wobbles.
He's right.
But is he? If I'm staring down a $50,000 renovation budget on top of a high $800,000 purchase price, does the fact that there's a pump track and a waterfall down the street truly protect my investment? It feels like a massive gamble.
It is only a gamble if you fail to understand how real estate depreciates. Let's drill down into the mechanics of durable fundamentals versus aesthetic trends.
Okay, I'm listening.
What typically artificially inflates the price of a house? Interior aesthetics.
Like what?
Well, in 2015, everyone paid a premium for Chevron tile and Edison bulbs. In 2020, it was shiplap walls and open concept floating shelves.
Oh, yeah. Everyone wanted shiplap.
The economic reality is that aesthetic trends are highly volatile and inherently depreciating. What looks cutting edge today will look deeply dated and undesirable in exactly 10 years.
That's true.
If you pay a $100,000 premium solely because a house has a newly flipped trendy kitchen, you are investing in a fading asset.
So the trendy kitchen becomes the liability of the next decade.
Exactly. But let's look at the assets of Whatcom Falls Park, a 241-acre forested ravine acting as an acoustic baffle and air purifier.
Yeah.
A hand-laid 1940 sandstone bridge steeped in community lore. A working trout hatchery where your children can safely learn the biological cycle of their ecosystem.
Right.
A continuous green trail artery that allows you to commute to a massive freshwater lake without ever crossing a highway. a world-class mountain biking facility less than a mile away.
Okay, when you list it out like that.
Because of durable fundamentals, they are immune to the whims of Pinterest interior design trends. You cannot manufacture them, you cannot cheaply replicate them, and they absolutely do not go out of style.
You can gut and remodel a 1970s kitchen in a month, but no amount of money can magically remodel a subdivision to suddenly feature a 25-year healed waterfall.
Precisely. So when a buyer pays top dollar for that dated ranch, they are not buying the drywall or the plumbing. They are securing a permanent coordinate on the map.
A coordinate on the map.
They are buying the irreplaceable civic and geographic access. That access is the floor beneath the property's value.
Which explains the broker's approach.
That is why the broker's guide is so deeply effective. He isn't trying to trick the buyer into believing the 1970s house is flawless. He outright demands they budget for inspections.
Because he's selling the outside.
He is confidently selling the unyielding permanence of the geography outside the house.
And he wraps up the guide by stating that if a buyer is weighing the Whatcom Falls neighborhood against adjacent areas like Silver Beach or Alabama Hill, he won't just email them a list of active links.
He wants to show them.
Yes, he promises to outline the honest trade-offs of each area, and he ends with this great line, "Reach out and I will meet you at the bridge."
Oh, that's good.
It's the perfect closing statement. It anchors the entire massive, complex real estate transaction right back to that tactile, historic, kintsugi-like stone over the water.
It grounds the financial decision in the physical reality of the community.
So we've unpacked the geography, the history, the ecology, and the economics. Let's pull all of these threads together.
Let's do it.
Whatcom Falls Park is infinitely more than a municipal boundary with some trees and a swing set. It is a wildly complex, functioning ecosystem.
It really is.
It manages to balance high decibel civic utility with its pump tracks and tennis courts against profound, contemplative, natural beauty.
The mullet park concept.
Right. And it holds the devastating, incredibly heavy trauma of the 1999 pipeline fire and simultaneously facilitates the joyful, generational community life of the spring fishing derbies.
It proves that the most valuable spaces in a city aren't the flawless, manicured, sanitized lawns.
No, they are the active, working, deeply scarred, but ultimately enduring arteries of the neighborhoods that surround them.
It is a masterclass in how environment dictates human behavior and community identity. From the acoustic brilliance of recreational zoning, to the demystification of nature at the trout hatchery, to the profound ecological bioremediation of the creek corridor.
It's a landscape that refuses to be passive.
Exactly. It demands that you participate, that you respect its hazards, and that you remember its history.
It demands you show up fully. And I want to leave you, the listener, with one final thought to mull over today as we conclude this deep dive.
Something to think about on your next walk.
Think about the physical and historical journey we just mapped out. When you walk across a bridge that was painstakingly assembled from the salvaged, burned ruins of a destroyed city building.
Yeah.
And that bridge is suspended over moving water, rushing through a forest that is still actively, vigorously regrowing from a catastrophic chemical fire.
That's a powerful image.
You are moving through a landscape that is defined entirely by its resilience. It is defined by its ability to absorb immense destruction and slowly, methodically, turn it back into life. So it begs the question, how do the physical spaces we choose to inhabit, the unvarnished histories we choose to remember, and the scarred parks we choose to walk through, ultimately shape our own internal capacity for recovery and endurance?
A vital question to carry with you on your next walk in the woods.
Until next time, keep diving deep.